This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.
Body Bags with Joseph Scott Moore. You know, I don't really know how man originally discovered fire. We always have this image in our minds. I don't know about you guys. I have it. Of, you know, these kind of Cro-Magnon looking creatures that are sitting around in a cave, and all of a sudden one of them, you know, strikes a rock against another rock, and suddenly they discover, you know, fire. I've always thought that maybe it was a lightning strike, perhaps, this kind of natural manifestation, maybe from the sweet Lord above. Something caught on fire and they were amazed by it, and they took it and they kept it. And it provided so much for them. It provided, it split the night at that point in time. No artificial light. Suddenly they had naturally occurring light where they could see in the darkness those things that were out there. Suddenly they had access to warmth when it was very, very cold. Can you imagine being in the midst of the ice age or at the end of the last ice age and you're freezing to death? But yet you have this glow that you can sit around and rub your hands in front of. They learned how to cook, perhaps, with fire. But now, in the modern context, fire represents many other things. We can manufacture things with it. We can fuel things. Industry runs on it. But in my world, Fire generally comes down to this. Something is being destroyed that maybe a criminal otherwise would not want to be found. Today on Body Bags, we're going to have kind of a brief primer, a brief discussion on fire and arson. I'm Joseph Scott Morgan, and this is Body Bags. Dave, the scaredest I have ever been at any type of scene, for me, this is me personally, okay? Let me run down this, let me break this down to you, were cases, not where there was an active shooter still running around, or there was an angry crowd, or something like that, because I had my share of those. It was always involving structure fires. First off, since I was a little boy, I've always been fascinated by firefighters, not cops. I was not one of those kids that wanted to be a cop. I always loved firefighters. And when I was little, I don't know if you remember this. Do you remember Texaco Fire Chief? It was like the gas.
Yeah.
And they used to have Texaco Fire Chief. Texaco used to sell firefighter helmets, and they were old-fashioned helmets. And you could get the deluxe model that had a radio that you could put in your ear inside.
Oh, my goodness,
and
no.
My uncle, who I regard in my life as the closest thing I really ever had to a father, he bought that from me. And
aww.
It was one of the most treasured gifts I ever had. And I always liked firefighters. I like firefighters as a death investigator because firefighters are fascinating in the sense that it doesn't matter to them if they get dirty. They don't care. And they've always got some new piece of equipment that they want to buy or something like that. It's like I could have the worst decomposed body in the world that is down a ravine, and there's a whole group of them over there saying, "Doc, you don't have to go down that hill. We'll send Jim and Bob down there, and we'll fashion this new kind of knot, and we'll put them in the basket, and we'll bring them up, or we'll dig out the hole around this area for you, you know." And it was always amazing. And, you know, I'd always have friends that were police officers out there, and they'd just be kind of standing back because, you know, firefighters and cops have this interesting relationship. And the cops were like, "I'm not going near that. I'm just not doing it." You know, firefighters, you know, of course, the old adage about them is, you know, when everybody else is running away, they're running in.
Right.
And so this world that around fire has always been terrifying to me. You know, the only times I've ever been injured at crime scenes have been at fire scenes. I've had,
wow.
Okay. Here's something cool. A little trivia about Morgan. I actually had a beam fall,
Jim,
and strike me in the head, and it was still on fire. It had a little, it had like a small flame on it, and the whole thing had burning embers on it.
Wow.
I hadn't completely doused it. I had a nail go through my boot into my foot. Really old pair of boots, by the way. I should have thrown those away. And I actually had electricity arc off of a puddle of water onto my foot. And
oh, no.
Tingling in my leg.
Yeah.
And I fell backwards. It stunned me for a second. And that was because there was an electrical line and they hadn't cut the power yet.
Oh.
The house. And they pulled the line down. So that's as close to death as I've really come. I've had shots fired over my head, but it was not. There's something about being in that world wow. of all that remains of a building, a structure, a car. There's kind of this infamous bridge down in New Orleans called the Huey P. Long Bridge, named after the governor from back in the 30s. And Dave, this thing was really narrow. It had two lanes on either side. And as a matter of fact, the bridge is this gigantic metal structure, steel structure. And there are entire families that have made their living off of this bridge as sandblasters because the thing always has to be refurbished.
Oh.
And in the middle of this bridge going across the river, at one point in time, there is a train track. And the train track also consists of the world's longest train trestle. And it starts way on one side of the Mississippi River, and it continues on to the what they call the West Bank. And I don't know if it's still the longest or not, but there was a guy that was in a Corvette that was driving over the top of it, racing somebody on this thing. And these lanes are really narrow. And Dave, he hit the curb on one side. And this is hundreds of feet in the air above the Mississippi River down below. He hit the curb, rolled the thing over, and it's when they had those, they were like the new total fiberglass bodies on this thing. Well, mm-hmm. I got there and the whole thing had been engulfed and it's windy up there. It's like really windy. And I thought that everything was out. The fire was doused. And dude, I got adjacent to the scene and all the firefighters are wearing respirators.
Right.
And they were like looking at me and I walked up and I found out why they were wearing respirators. Because this fiberglass was burning in there. And dude, they had to take me back and the EMTs had to put me on oxygen because I was inhalating this thing or inhaling. I'm sorry, inhaling this gas coming off of this or the product coming off of it. It's a weird world. You walk into any kind of home that has been destroyed. And I may have mentioned this before on Body Bags, but you walk into it and as a death investigator, who knows a little bit about arson, very little, I walk into that environment and everything looks black and charred. I can't make out detail. I've even lost bodies inside of houses because I can't tell where the ceiling that has caved in or the furniture that is burned down. I can't delineate between the body that is also charred that is in there. It's a weird kind of it's the most unique environment that you ever go into. And people often forget about arson investigators as being part of the forensic community. You know, they think, I don't know what they think about arson, but to me, they are at the top of the heap because they have to know something about everything. Most of them are firefighters and cops. They testify. They are top-end experts in their field. They understand chemistry. They understand physics. And they also understand how to run a homicide investigation. And so their skill set is something that most people don't understand. And they are amazed. I love talking to them because I learn. I just try to keep my mouth shut, which is hard for me. Keep my eye and my ears open and just listen. But, you know, one of the rudimentary things that you have to learn is kind of the nature of fire. And we don't normally, you don't give fire much consideration. You've seen pictures of me and my family. We go out even in the wintertime on our boat and there's an island not too far from where we keep our boat. And we take firewood out there and just build a big bonfire and sit around the bonfire. Most people don't think about that. What is fire? What's the nature of it? You know, kind of how it works. So fire itself has four components to it. And so let me just kind of run these down to you. You have to have a fuel source, okay? And sometimes the fuel source can be rolled into what's also referred to as accelerants. That's like if you, let's just say you're using a charcoal grill, all right? Well, the charcoal in there is fuel, right? But in order to initiate that charcoal into a sustainable fire or have it burn, you have to put lighter fluid on it most of the time, all right? I know that there's some brands out there that say you don't need it, but that's how
they lie.
Yeah,
they lie.
So you get it started like that, and so the thing burns. But you also have to strike off a match or use a lighter to get the thing initiated. Well, you have to have fuel in order for that to happen. No, it seems simplistic. You have to have heat. And what I mean by that is heat is a product of an actual burning fire. So that's heat is one of the components. You have to have oxygen. Remember, how many times have we heard about there being a fire in a location where the fire literally runs out of oxygen in the room and completely consumes it, and so it dies, all right? That's the reason, for instance, like with, if you've ever heard of a halon fire extinguisher, mm-hmm. they use them on boats. You can't see it. It's invisible. Actually,
really?
Autoerotic case involving halon canisters. A guy was inhaling the stuff, and what it does is it binds with the oxygen, and it's an oxygen deprivant, and so it just knocks the oxygen down. So you have to have oxygen, all right? And then you have to have an uninhibited chemical reaction, and this chemical reaction has to be ongoing. If you think about going to chemistry class and you're demonstrating and you see this immediate reaction where something bubbles over or you have this reactive change in color or whatever you're working on in the lab, that's kind of a one-off kind of thing. But you think about fire. Fire is truly an ongoing chemical experiment because it has to be sustained. And if you're absent any of these components, it's going to go out. I mean, just think about it. Back to the idea of heat. If a fire dies out, there is an insufficient amount of heat being generated in order to burn the fuel that's existing there. So those are essentially the four main components of fire. And without that, you don't really have a fire per se. Now, you might get like a flashover where an individual might be in a room, and I've actually had this happen, Dave, where they come in, an arsonist has come in, and they spread gasoline all in a room. And this one particular future rocket scientist did this with a couple of gallons of gas. The windows and the doors were closed in the room, and this idiot strikes a match. And of course, it kills him. But after it burned off, you know, that gas that was on the floor and everything, it was non-sustainable. First off, the room that he was in had a marble tile floor.
Oh, so my goodness.
That's not going to burn.
Wow.
And the ceiling had asbestos. It was a really old room. So I don't know where this guy did his research or whatever.
Wow.
But it didn't burn. You know, it was non-sustainable, but it killed him. So, you know, you have to be in this kind of sustainable environment for it to actually continue to thrive in this environment, because absent that, you're just not going to have the end product of a fire that is burning before you. You know, where you think about sitting around a campfire, and some of the most fun you'll ever have at a campfire is actually taking a piece of wood when it's beginning to die down and placing the foot on, and you're sustaining that. You're sustaining that uninhibited chemical reaction, and it's burning up before you. The fuel is literally vaporizing in the air before you. You're receiving heat off of it. You're receiving comfort. You're roasting marshmallows or weenies or whatever it is that you're doing.
Were you a fire bug as a kid? Did you like light matches in the bathroom? I mean, I'm thinking you're like Andrew was,
I really
man.
Didn't, but I just, yeah. Well, maybe Andrew and I, your son, have that in common. I don't know. But have you ever noticed that fire is a weird thing in the sense that it has almost like a hypnotic effect on
Some people, it does.
You sit there and you just, have you ever seen anybody at a fireside and they'll just stare at the fire and they'll just kind of rock back and forth? You know, at Christmas time when they put the thing on the they run the thing with the fire burning, right, and you hear it popping and crackling. I don't ever, Dave, I promise you, I watch stuff on my phone. I rarely, if ever, turn, and I've got a huge TV in my house. I rarely turn this thing on. But yet, if that thing's on at Christmas time, I'll find myself like in a trance, just listening to pop and listening to Perry Como singing in the background.
Oh, those dag blasted chestnuts. They're roasting over an open fire, man. Wow.
So, and it's an amazing thing. But here's the rub with fire. Fire does, in fact, provide us with many of the essentials that we are dependent upon in this life. We couldn't survive without it nowadays in modern times. We always have access to it. I can't tell you how many spare matchbooks I have in my house and lighters and all these sorts of things. And, you know, if I had to, I could, you know, I could take a flint and I could strike it and I could create a fire. But fire also has one other element to it. It is arguably the most, if not one of the most destructive forces in the world. All you got to do is take a look out west during wildfire season. Take a look recently at the Palisades out there around Malibu in that area. And it gives you an idea of what happens when fire burns out of control. There are two images from the Vietnam era that will always stay with me, that I've seen in the news, and I know many of you guys have. And those images are the young child that's running down the road, and she doesn't have her clothes on. And she was in a village where her village got hit with napalm, which is essentially gelatinous gasoline. And it doesn't matter what you do, you can't extinguish it. As a matter of fact, that young girl became a grown woman and she survived. The other image is of the monk that we've seen images of from Southeast Asia in protests for peace. He goes into a lotus position and has poured apparently accelerant all over himself and his robes and has set himself ablaze and sat there and never moved. And no pun intended, those images are burned into my brain. I can't unsee that. And when we're in the world of fire investigation and viewing things from the perspective of what crime has been committed, arson itself is a category that stands alone among all the others because it's used for a variety of reasons. And, obviously the girl in the napalm strike, that was a product of war. That's not arson. You have this monk that was doing this in protest. That's not arson. But it has a level of lethality and it has a level of destruction that criminals have come to appreciate for a long, long time now, because they believe that if they set something ablaze, that they're going to eradicate any opportunity for us to collect evidence at a scene. And I've often held that if, in fact, you can go back and conduct your investigation thoroughly, I believe that arsonists leave more evidence behind by starting fires. You know, they use particular types of accelerant, whether it be kerosene, gasoline, fuel oil. I've seen fires started with electricity, intentionally set, phosphorus triggers, all these other things that are out there. And you're getting into high-end things. You know, you start talking about electrical fires that are intentionally set as opposed to somebody running down to the local, you know, Stop and Rob and getting a gallon of gasoline and coming back home and dousing the place. It's a bit more sophistication involved in that. And so arsonists actually come in all shapes and sizes, but their motivations are really varied. I mean, you've got, I think most popularly, you think about people destroying things for money, insurance money. They set houses on fire, structures on fire, businesses on fire, and try to collect off of that. Of course, you have in our area in death investigation, you have an individual who's dead inside of a house. The house has been, you know, just engulfed with flames. And what they're trying to do is trying to render down that body so that there's nothing left that we can go back and examine.
It's amazing to me how many times people do that. They burn a house down to cover up the murder of somebody they shot in the head in their recliner. Yeah. And it's like, dude, you realize how long it takes to render a body down? Things I've learned from Joseph Scott Morgan by doing body bags. It's like, it's not going to happen. If you're going to go to crime school, that should be like day three. Don't do this.
Yeah. And but yet they persist, don't they, Dave?
I'm love them.
Yeah. I mean, like you think about, you remember the case Tara Grinstead out of Georgia. We've covered that for years. And it's not just me. Nancy.
She was missing for so long.
Yeah. And, you know, when they, and I remember, I think I did an episode of Body Bags on that case because there was a lot of static about a couple of years ago. Both those fellows were in court again. But anyway, she was found in an old pecan orchard down in South Georgia. Something I learned about pecan wood at that particular time that I was fascinated by that I did not know. Did you know that next to hickory, pecan is the hottest burning wood that's out there? And the fact that they had scrap pecan wood out there that I believe that they used as fuel source for her body, because keep in mind, human bodies are not fuel sources. All right. They're not. They make lousy fuel sources. So it requires you to put the body with a fuel source, stack fuel source on top of the body, underlay the body with fuel source, put an accelerant on the body, and you begin that process of rendering down a body. And Dave, they burned that lady's body for so long that they were only able to find little bits of her left behind. That was almost a successful attempt at criminal arson there.
That case, with Tara Grinstead, I'm glad you brought it up, because that was one of those ones where I learned when you were talking about the different, I don't know that much about a lot of the things we end up talking about because I'm not learned in that area. But when you start studying a case and you start breaking it down and you're going, why did this not work and why did this work? And it's amazing to me how some of the stupidest people can come up with the best ways. And some of the smartest people are so stupid when it comes to crime. But I will tell you, firing up something I used to think was a good idea until we started doing this show. I'm not a criminal. I'm not going to be burning stuff down. I would have thought, you know, hey, if you're going to ruin your prints and everything else, go ahead and light it on fire. But actually, may as well pour super glue on it.
Yeah. Yeah. And you are creating, that's why I always say you're creating more evidence, I believe.
Right.
And evidence of, and listen, if you go out, here's another big one, and this is kind of a broad assertion here, but if you go out and purchase a gallon of gasoline for this express purpose, that goes to intent. You know, which is kind of the body of a crime. You know, you're thinking about, did you intend to do this? It's really hard to explain away why we have you on CCTV taking a gallon jug or taking a gallon gas can or 5 gallon gas can and filling it up with gas when you don't normally do that. And then suddenly there's a blaze in your backyard. You walk out there and there's human remains there. So it kind of, you know, the act of actually doing that, even more so than going out and buying a gun, because there's a lot of reasons you can say, well, I went out and bought a gun. I wanted it for home defense. Maybe I've had it laying around the house. But, you know, you get a lot of people, and I've covered these cases where individuals will show up and they'll have in the back of their pickup truck several cans that are empty, top them off, and go back. And it's within just a short bit of time that they're burning a body.
Right.
So, you know, you've got this idea of eradication of evidence. And yeah, clothing burns away to a great degree. But did you know that, like, when we have bodies that have been burned, Let's just say, just imagine in your mind, you've got somebody laying on their back. All right. Mm-hmm. And you pour gas all over the anterior or the front of their body, strike a match, and the anterior portion of their body envelops in flame, right? Mm-hmm. Well, do you know the clothing on the backside many times is intact? It doesn't just all burn. I mean, just think about it. We talked about oxygen just a moment ago.
Yeah.
So if the body is in contact with the floor or the ground, fire is always going to seek oxygen, all right? And so it's not going to go. It might burn for a second if you've got gas that has kind of leached into the ground around it, but it's not really sustainable. It's not burning away all of the clothing. Clothing's a big part of like getting bodies identified, learning where they come from. Also, if there's any trauma, because, you know, if you've got somebody that's been shot in the back or they've been beaten, you're not destroying that evidence, that physical evidence that exists there. So when you get these really sophisticated guys, like, and I know I've mentioned this book on air again, I'm going to do it again because I want everybody to read it, Murder in Coweta County. There was a guy that was murdered back in the 30s, I think. Or the 40s, I can't remember, in Georgia. And the guy that facilitated that had his, what he referred to as his hired men, which were these two African-American fellows, to tend the fire. And they constantly pumped wood into this fire pit with this guy's body in it. And they turned the coals. They turned his body in there, almost like they're cooking.
Wow.
And the body begins to render down till there was nothing left but ash. And you know how they retrieved, in that case, they retrieved what became known in that specific case. This is a concept in law. You hear the term the corpus delicti, which means the body. Dave, they found one little chip of bone that was caught in an eddy in a creek where they dumped these burlap sacks. Because they even went to the trouble of taking shovels, digging out the hole, and putting them into these sacks, going to the creek and dumping the sacks in the creek and then burning the sacks. But yet that one little bit of bone was evidence. And this is before, and that's kind of an assumption, scientific assumption, because biologically back during that time, they had no way to tie it back to that guy. All they knew is that they had a bone or a piece of a bone even, but they used that. And you know, that was the only case, that was the first case, I think maybe in American history, where the testimony of an African-American man was used to put a white man in the electric chair and he died. They fried his ass.
Wow.
So yeah. And it's kind of a seminal case. So Murder in Coweta County, you ever get a chance, read the book. There was a movie that was done with Andy Griffith and Johnny Cash back in the early 80s, but the book is fantastic. And it talks about, and fire plays a big part of that. Then we've got another group that you've heard of, Pyromania, which is,
Def Leppard album.
Yeah, it's not that, but Fire Brigade, you know, got it made or whatever it is. But yeah, pyromania is a sexual affectation, you know, where they have this idea that they get gratification from watching fire. I'd mentioned before the show that I won't go into all of the details. I was at a conference one time and I was talking to these investigators and they had mentioned how this one fellow they had worked this case, fire battalion responds to a fully engulfed home. And there's like a family of five burning to death in the home. And, I'll put it to you delicately. He's standing in the street, fully nude and fully aroused when they arrive, fixated on the fire. So, you know,
he set the fire, Joe? Do you know? I mean, did he do that? Or
yeah, it was specifically for his own sexual
education.
And so,
I
never read about that case. That was just passed on to me from them.
Wow.
And I was thinking, you know, I talk about there's no basement in the house.
Yeah, there is.
It's just endless. It's bottomless. You think you've seen it all. And then, you know, you get to that point where, you know, you haven't. And then other people burn for other reasons. You've got these revenge burnings that take place where people, and these are where, you know, I'm going to destroy you. I'm going to eradicate everything. I reflect back, and I know that some of our listeners will remember this precious child back then, that his dad and mom were in a custody battle, and the dad set this kid on fire and scarred him for life. And that has happened many times over the years. There was the one movie, I can't remember which one it was, where the lady, I think it was Angela Bassett, people are going to remember this movie, where, you know, her husband was, you know, running around on her, and she took all of his clothes, knocked the window out of his Mercedes, put his clothes in the car, poured gas in the car, and she strikes a match and sets the Mercedes and the clothes on fire, you know, in the driveway. So, yeah, I mean, you have this idea of revenge as well. So concealment of crime, revenge, personal monetary gain. Wow. You know, you can have that. You have people that contract to do arson. There are people that are skilled at it, believe it or not.
Well, in the movie Goodfellas, it showed, you know, the guys over there burning the club. Remember?
Yeah.
For insurance money.
Yeah, absolutely. It was that was Joe Pesci and Henry Hill's character did that. I'll tell you, one of the most chilling depictions of an arsonist is actually Mickey Rourke. And people might not remember this. He played that role in the movie Body Heat.
Oh, wow.
William Hurt. And he gives one of the most chilling recitations on arson that you've ever heard. And he,
really?
You know, and he was depicted as a pro at doing this. And there are people that can do this, and they sell themselves as somebody that can cover up their crimes and not, you know, not be caught by virtue of them. They essentially cover all of their bases. But a couple of things that you're looking for and that we look for at scenes, most of the time with fire, with arson, is that we'll have individuals that will take, say, for instance, an accelerant. And when I say accelerant, just think gasoline, for instance. It can be any number of things. But arson investigators look for things like splash patterns. For instance, if you take a bucket of gasoline and you toss it on a wall, and you know, it's sheetrock wall, gypsum, you strike a match and you set it ablaze. Well, did you know that you can actually, those arson investigators can actually follow the splash pattern on the wall, that it'll burn into it. You can see it where if you think about splashing a wall with something, striking a match and putting it to the wall, you'll see the pattern of the splash, kind of how it, and most of the time, another rule of thumb that we use, wherever, it doesn't happen every time, but wherever you see, particularly in a structure, the most damage has occurred, that is going to point you toward the point of origin of the fire, because it's burned the longest. You know, unless you have like a store of gasoline in the house or something that's explosive that does more damage, most of the time you're going to have an area that has more damage than any other location. Those are just like a few of the things, you know, that you kind of look for at a fire scene. If they're trying to determine exactly where the point of origin is. So source, point of origin, what utility did they use to start this with? Did they just take like old newspapers and pile them up in a corner? Anything else that's flammable, and they set that ablaze. If you get in there and you've got furniture that's burned in place, but it's all askew and maybe in one corner, you get an idea when you walk in there that, okay, the furniture was actually intended to be the fuel source, because, you know, you're not going to have like your lazy boy and a sofa stacked on top of one another.
Right.
And it doesn't matter. I mean, if it catches on fire, that's not necessarily going to mean that the lazy boy is going to fall off of the sofa. It's going to burn in place most of the time. Now, the firefighters might pull it down, but you'll have it all kind of congregated in that area. You look for those little cues like that at a scene. And you also look for position of the body. You know, what is it that stands out about a body if you're dealing with a body at a scene? What is it that's there that kind of stinks? And I don't mean that literally. I mean that in the sense of, from an investigative, what is it that just doesn't seem right in this particular environment? You know, for us in death investigation, we see what remains of this. We see all that's left behind. The big question is, who and what started this inferno? I still have a memory of the first time I was ever faced with a burned body in the morgue. There's actually two things. I stand corrected. I remember two things that I saw in the morgue related to fire. The first one's kind of standard stuff. It was still shocking for my young eyes to behold at that time, because I realized I was looking at a human being that had been burned. And it was a homicide and a subsequent arson, where the structure that they were in was set on fire after the individual had been shot. And the fire had been really, really hot. And my first reaction was, when I saw the body, and I mean no disrespect by this, but it looked to me, in my untrained eye, it looked like something that had fallen off of a grill into the charcoal briquettes below. And it was black. The body was black, drawn. You could barely make out any clothing that remained. No facial features. Hair was all gone. The hands were claw-like. And I remember looking at that body, and it gave off, to be perfectly honest with you, it gave off the smell of burned meat. And I remember I couldn't, and this is my personal recollection here again, for the longest time, I couldn't eat, grilled meat. I have a distinct memory of that. And I was, you know, this young, virile, you know, guy that I loved a steak. I loved hamburgers, all that stuff. Still do to this day, but I got past that. But I remember being kind of repulsed by it. That was my first. And then on top of it, I had to go into that body with a scalpel and open the body. And so, because I was the autopsy assistant. And so you kind of get a double dose of it. Now, if you can imagine, Dave, even more horrific than that was the first time that I ever assisted in the autopsy on an individual that had been burned in a house fire and had, I'm doing air quotes, had survived for a month on the burn unit at a hospital in New Orleans. And for any of you out there that have had family members that have been burned and been subjected to intense heat, you're going to understand what I'm saying. It's a real specialty in medicine to be able to deal with burn patients. It's unlike anything else. I guess you get satisfaction from it because you know that you're trying to help them, trying to help them move on, trying to reconstruct their life if they can survive, because it's once a certain percentage of your body is burned, there's high probability you're no longer going to be able to fight off all the little nasties that are outside trying to attack you. Many folks die of septicemia. You know, there's a myriad of things that they die from. But Dave, I remember this one fellow, and he was massive. And when I say massive, he may, at that point when I saw him, may have been the biggest body I'd ever seen come into the autopsy room. So when we were observing him, I remember talking to the forensic pathologist, and he was saying, this is what it looks like to be on a burn unit, be a patient on a burn unit. And we had the reports before us. In life, this guy had been 185 pounds. So he had been in the burn unit for a month. And what happens is many times these people go into renal failure and they can't outprocess fluids. And he was so swollen, Dave. Well, along with the swelling, what has to happen, because the skin on these individuals actually splits. So in advance of that, the surgeon will come in and they make these linear incisions in the body, and they're all over the body. You've never seen the like of it. It rivals anything I've ever seen in the autopsy room. And they will make these surgical incisions that are rather lengthy all over the surface of the skin, because if they don't, the skin on its own, because of the tension and the retention of water and fluid in the body, they will begin to split open. So they have to make incisions all over the body to try to, you know, stem that. And eventually the body just, it cannot function to a point where it's a survivable event, and they're going to die. And many people, I always have this question, and it doesn't necessarily revolve around fire related deaths, but you have these events where people will say, well, they were in the hospital for a long time. Why did you have to do an autopsy? Well, yes, you're absolutely right. The injuries are documented. Everything has been x-rayed and photographed, and you've got the treatment records, surgical records. We've got, in case of burn victims, we've got every time a skin graft has been attempted. I mean, just, it's voluminous. There's always charting going on, but we're still going to do the autopsy. The reason we're still going to do the autopsy is that this is a homicide. This is a homicide. And if you don't do the autopsy, even if a person's been in the hospital for a protracted period of time, when this thing goes to court, a defense attorney will look at this and say, well, how do we know what really killed this individual? You're saying that just based on the doctor's notes here, that it's a, you know, that, yeah, they got burned, but yet you didn't do an autopsy. How can you prove that? And you kind of head that off at the pass by having a forensic pathologist look at not just the records, but actually taking a look at the body in total there in the autopsy room. And for me, it stuck with me, that first body that I saw, a lot of them after that, but that first body that I saw that came off of a burn unit that had been treated for a protracted period of time, it stuck with me. You know, it really, it made me think. It was one of those cases where when you look at the individual, and I don't think about this a lot, where I go around saying, I hope they didn't suffer. Mm-hmm. A lot of families say that, and you don't really know if people suffer, but I look at that, and that's one of those cases where you think, I hope they weren't aware of this, because it was so grotesque and horrible, you know, when you see this. And that part of me within me, and I don't think I'm not being sadistic when I say this, that's one of the reasons I think that people that have murdered others need to be present for autopsies. And I know it's not legally possible, you know, because people are presumed innocent until proven guilty. But you want people that have done great harm to individuals to understand what happens to subjects. And when you see somebody that's burned like this, subjected to severe heat, intense heat, it really gives you pause. It's like you want that individual to see what they have done, because they're not going to go through this. Their family's not going to go through this. And it's really, you know, it really throws up the stop sign in your spirit, you know, where it's so over the top, Dave.
But Joe, what about the term burned to death?
Yeah.
We've heard that said by people on, you know, talk shows that, you know, on crime, that the body, the person burned to death. And that's not true, is it?
In most cases, it's not. Now, you have, like I just gave you the example. Mm-hmm. I gave everybody the example of the person that's on the burn unit.
Right.
They, most of the time when you have a homicide, or let's just say it's an accidental death. Let's don't necessarily say homicides. Let's just say an accidental death as related to fire. most people do not burn to a crisp and die like that. Okay. That's not how it necessarily works. It's not like the last scene in the original Raiders of the Lost Ark, you know, where people are incinerating and that sort of thing by the presence of God coming out of the Ark of the Covenant.
All right. So that was not a documentary. Is that what you're telling me?
No, that was not a documentary. Most people in our world that are subjected to a fire, an environment involving fire, are going to die as a result of smoke inhalation. Almost, I'd say probably 99%, maybe not that many, 95% of those deaths. And it's from inhaling those bits that are in the air. And it's not like you're just inhaling smoke. Most people don't understand the components. Smoke is a product of things burning up. It's actually one of the subcomponents of fire. You're talking about when fuel is vaporized. Okay, so when it's vaporized and it extends out, that if you're in that environment, you're trying to get your breath. What did they always tell us when we were kids? If there was a house fire, you're supposed to do what? You're supposed to go to the floor and crawl along the floor.
Yeah.
Because that's where the remaining oxygen is, all that stuff floating up in the air, and they're absolutely right, is toxic. So it's not, and this is not, if you're, let's just say you're in a house, or you could be inside of a car, all of those elements within that car, which are man-made, really let that hang there for a second, that are man-made, are going to indwell that environment, and they're going to burn. And remember how we said earlier on where I was talking about an uninhibited chemical reaction. Well, if you've got like carpet, okay, you've got some kind of synthetic carpet in a house and it's burning. Did you know that one of the major components of carpet is petroleum? It's petroleum based. And so how's all that bound together? Well, it's very complex chemically. All right. So once heat is subjected to that, you kind of free all that stuff up that's in the carpet, and all of a sudden it's floating around the air. Dave, you can find things like arsenic floating around, you know, in this environment. So when you get, you know, people breathing in a fire, you'll see these components on their toxicology that are coming back, and it's amazing. It's this litany, this list of stuff that's kind of free floating around in their blood that they've taken on. Not to mention the absence of actual breathable oxygen in this environment. One of the main components that we're looking for, though, you know, that's going to lead to death is going to be, you know, carbon monoxide asphyxiation. It literally turns the body cherry pink. The skin is pink. Nail beds are pink. The eyes are pink. You open up the body, the viscera, the organs have a pink hue. The blood, when you draw it out, it looks like, the only way I've been able to describe it to people, think about a manufactured piece of candy that's like this brilliant pink color that was created in a lab. The first candy that comes to me, I used to love these when I was a kid, were not now laters or what they were called. And they're kind of hard taffy. And there was a pink one in there. That's what the viscera looks like throughout the body. The blood is even that color. And the carbon monoxide turns the blood, absent the oxygen, that color. So if we see that color manifesting itself just visually, we're going to run a test that's called a carboxyhemoglobin level. But when you see that pink, automatically the alarm bell goes off and you know that this person has inhaled carbon monoxide along with this myriad of other things, you know, in the environment. And it's non-compatible with life. The balance gets so out of whack because we require a certain amount of oxygen. And, you know, we don't live in a pure oxygen environment anyway. You know, people talk about the oxygen air and yeah, it's there. So, but you're breathing in these other components, all, you know, there's nitrogen out there, there's carbon dioxide that you're rebreathing sometimes. You know, plants take up carbon dioxide, they produce oxygen, that sort of thing. And so all these elements are kind of floating around, but it's sustainable with life. When you get in that closed environment, like a home, and you're literally swimming in a chemical experiment at this point in time, and the fire that's in there is like the Bunsen burner you would have in a lab. only it's visible. You're in the midst of it and you're trying to gasp for air and there's nothing really left for you to grab hold of, to breathe, that sort of thing. And as heat increases around the body, most of the time the person is going to die within a few minutes. And there is an awareness. If you don't try to shade yourself into this idea that there's no awareness that you're dying. I mean, if anybody has ever struggled with breathing, if you've ever had pneumonia or anything like that, you know what it's like to be short of breath. If you ever had a heart event, you know what it's like to be short of breath. Same principle here. There's an awareness. It's a horrible way to die because your brain is screaming, I need oxygen, I need oxygen. So when they finally die, then comes the heat. And I think that that's where this idea that people say, well, they burn to death. And it's kind of convenient to say that because you've got a fire, you've got this event that occurs where the house is caving in around them. They're surrounded by intense flames and people think they burn to death. Now, there are cases where people have literally had gasoline thrown all over the body. Hey, there was just a case, remember, Dave, back in Virginia last week, that house, yep, the representative, yeah, in Virginia, the guy walks up with a bucket of gasoline,
yep,
and throws it on this guy and flicks a match on him or strikes a lighter or whatever this nut job does and set this guy on blaze, this poor guy.
Yeah.
I don't, at this moment, Thomas, we're talking right now, I don't know what his status is. I pray for him and his family. I hope he's okay. But he was talking, you know, when he left, but
yeah,
you know, he's on the burn unit somewhere, and this is going to be a long uphill battle for him. But it's heat. But go ahead, Dave. I'm sorry.
I was going to ask you about Mercedes Vega.
Yeah,
out in Arizona, in Maricopa County. It was one of the stories that you had sent, and I thought if we could just briefly, if she's an exotic dancer, right?
Yeah.
And they find her on the highway.
Yeah, in the car. Yeah,
okay.
In the car. And the car is ablaze at that point.
All right.
Yeah.
Now, if you find a car with a body inside.
Yeah.
I'm going to assume that the person was not there of their own free will.
Yeah.
Wrong assumption if you're an investigator, but I'm not. I'm a journalist. So I'm just thinking out loud. How do you go into that? As an investigator, you're looking at a dead body in a car. Murder, suicide, accidental death. Can you be overcome with smoke so that you couldn't get yourself out of it? Can it happen that fast?
I think that, that's an excellent question. I think that the circumstances would have to be just right. Say, for instance, if you've got a fire that starts, let's just say it's an accidental fire. There are people who die in car accidents as a result of a fire catching, a vehicle catching fire. And it's like, and this is really horrible. I didn't talk about these, but you have what are called entrapment fires. Where a person can't get free of the car, you've got like maybe engine block intrusion, the fuel line gets clipped, it sparks off, and the person is literally sitting there. And then in those cases, there have been those cases where individuals literally do burn to death. But in her case, where you have a body that's found in a car, and the car and the body are both burning, when I hear hoofbeats, I'm not going to think camel. Okay. I'm pretty much going to think that this individual has probably sustained some kind of lethal injury and the people that perpetrated this wanted to burn the car up in order to get away with it. So with her case in particular, I think that it's important to understand that when they would do an examination, the ideal circumstances to do this examination would be not to remove her from the car, not to remove her from the car. Yeah. The idea would be to take the car with her body in it, put it onto the back of a flatbed, like a wrecker flatbed, tarp it up, cover it in tarps and take it to the crime lab and process the car with the body in it.
Have you ever had a tarp fall off
when you're transporting? Let's see.
Or heard about it?
No, I have not had that happen. I've never had that happen. I've heard of cases non-associated with offices that I'm aware of where part of the flap came loose and it's like blowing in the wind as it's going down. You have to be very, very careful because
that'd be horrible.
Yeah, it would be. There have been cases. There was a famous case that I'm aware of. I think it was in South Georgia where delivery service actually failed to secure the rear door. and the body on the body gurney came out of the back of the car and came out of the back. It was a hearse, but it was a van hearse,
right.
You know, that was operated as a private contractor, rolled out into the middle of the highway and turned over, and then a car ran over the body. It hit it. So you have to be very, very, you have to treat, not just from an evidentiary standpoint, but for the dead and their family, mm-hmm. you have to make sure that you're treating these bodies with the utmost respect, particularly in, I mean, the person that body represents has gone through enough. The family will soon be going through enough once they're notified of this. But we do know this. We do know that the body holds a lot of evidence that you have to be able to assess. You want to get the body into a prime, ideal set of circumstances. One of the interesting things that we see with fire deaths, I have folks ask me about this a lot. Had one lady ask me, she said, how was it she phrased it to me one time? She said, what's boxing got to do with fire? And it didn't register with me what she was saying. And I was at a conference, like a true crime thing. And we talked about it, and she had said, I've heard that their bodies move in fire. I was like, oh, you're talking about the pugilistic position. And so as a body is subjected to fire, and you can't really draw any conclusions or scientific conclusions, like were they alive versus dead when the fire started? All bodies are going to do this. But the bodies at the joints, even at the hip flexors, the knees, the feet, the elbows, the hands, it's all going to draw up. And the back years ago when they began to see this, the powers that be looked at this and said, wow, that looks just like a pugilist. And of course, pugilism is the old term for boxing. And so when you'll get these people that have their hands that will clench, their hands will clench and they'll draw up. I'm going to conclude this episode of Body Bags with something I don't normally do. I'm going to tell a story real quick. And you can actually see it. It's in the first chapter of my book, Blood Beneath My Feet. And I was really at the end of my career. I had enough and was really struggling with PTSD and these things that I was going through. And one night, I was in the middle of Georgia 400, and I worked a case of a young man that was in a Ford Ranger, and he slammed into a bridge abutment, and it was pouring down rain. His car had caught on fire, and he was entrapped. As I'm trying to work the case and examine his body, something happened to me that changed the course of my life and certainly my career that day. As the rain kind of dripped down off of my face and down my glasses, I couldn't see real well. I leaned into the cab, and this young man was entrapped, and he had burned to death in his car. And as I reached over to try to detect if his seat belt was buckled, his left hand brushed my right cheek. And instinctively, I reached up, grabbed the wrist of this clawed hand, and it snapped off in mine. I stand there in the rain. No one else is with me. Cops are off doing their thing. And I considered what I was holding in my hand just for a second, this burned claw that was left behind. I walked off into the night. I sat beneath the bridge. And I wept, shaking uncontrollably, asking myself, what in the world was I doing? Why was I here? That was after a 20-year career. And that night, my life changed. It changed because I knew that I could no longer do this. And fire played a big role in that stop sign. We all have stop signs in our lives, don't we? Those warning signs that pop up. And a case like this involving fire was my stop sign. And pretty soon thereafter, I had to give it up, had to hang it up. So fire will always be part of who I am. It will always be part of those things I talk about. It will always be part of the stories of the Dead. I'm Joseph Scott Morgan, and this is Body Bags.
This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.